Tech support hour with Corinna the alpaca.
Hi, TERFs and trannies. Welcome to Heterodorks. Yeah, I'm Nina Paley, your co-host, a canceled artist with a short-term memory problem.
Good. It's probably all that medicine you're taking for your Crohn's disease, Nina. And I'm Corinna Cohn, an aspiring alpaca and shelf stalker, formerly of, I don't know, international fame, I guess. And today we have with us a special guest. He is the editor of Outsports, Sid Ziegler, who is one of the journalists who has been covering the inclusion of gays and lesbians in sports for quite some time, if I understand, Sid. Sid, welcome to Heterodorks.
Yeah, 25 years we've been talking about this stuff. So it's before it was en vogue, and now everybody wants to talk about it.
So that was in 1999 that you started?
It was, yeah.
Outsports, cool.
I was 5 years old then.
Yeah, that's, you're precocious.
So, how has Outsports changed since you started?
Oh, it's changed a lot. At first, we just talked about kind of pro sports from a gay men's fandom angle, and you know, now we lead the world in writing about LGBTQ athletes coming out. Obviously, the conversation about transgender athletes has changed a lot in those 25 years. There was barely anybody to talk about in 1999, and now there's plenty to talk about. So it's been, we've seen a lot change in that time.
Yeah, and you have, did it start small? Like, how did the...
Yeah, it was just two guys. It was my business partner, Jim Bozinski, and me. We were just friends who played in the Gay Flag Football League here in L.A., and he was an editor at the L.A. Times. I was an executive at Disney Channel. And we just kind of realized that there was nobody out there talking about being a sports fan or a gay athlete from our perspective. So we just started throwing stuff up on a pretty rudimentary website. And, you know, it's evolved to what it is today. How did your podcast start?
It's a pandemic project.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Is Outsports in print?
No. It's hard enough starting a website. Forget about trying to print something over the last 20 years as online internet has emerged. So you got to be kind of crazy to start a print magazine these days.
Yeah. Well, it was those days, though. I mean, 1999.
Even those days, you were still kind of crazy just to print something. The writing was on the wall, but where print was at it.
Got so it. Nina and I were warming up a little earlier, and I was mentioning that to me, maybe the first big story about a gay athlete, professional athlete, not college athlete, was probably Michael Sam, who was a football player who briefly played with the St. Louis Rams before you Los Angelinos rudely captured the football team from the poor Midwesterners.
It was 10 years ago that Michael came out, but even before that, we had Robbie Rogers, who was a player in Major League Soccer, and Jason Collins, who was a player in the NBA. They were both active athletes when they came out on rosters the year before. Before that, there was Cheryl Swoops, who was a WNBA star. And then, of course, we've had you know, Olympians come out, but certainly in men's,
yeah,
pro sport. Yes,
you know,
Jason, Robbie, and Michael are kind of like the trifecta, all within about a year.
And you just caught me actually, because I said the first gay athlete, but there have been gay women like Martina Navratilova, who have been out in sports a long time before male pro athletes.
Yeah, Billie Jean King and Martina in the early 80s. I mean, Billie Jean was really outed, and Martina was intending to come out, and the journalist that she had done an interview with kind of sprung it on her early. So, yeah, those two certainly are legends.
Yeah, Martina, if you're listening, I'm sorry, but also call me.
I've met Martina a couple of times. I mean, she was on my podcast a couple of years ago, and I met her, I'll tell you, about 15 years ago, I did a sit-down interview with her in New York, she has a reputation of being a bit of a hard ass. Mm. She couldn't have been nicer. Like, we were supposed to be a 20-minute interview. She gave me an hour. And I was like, wow, that's not often that happens.
I've had the fortune of being able to talk to her in a meeting before. And she, if she had gone into business, into sports, she would have like just be a CEO right now. She's very witty, very smart.
Yeah, she's extremely bright. And you know, this, the whole transgender athlete conversation, it's been interesting just to see her evolve and the conversation evolve. Yeah, but you know, I still think a lot of people at OutSports, it's been hard because it is tough for me to hear some of the stuff that she says about trans athletes. But also, what a legend. And she really did a lot of great stuff for the LGB community.
So you said that the conversation's evolving. How has it evolved for you?
What conversation?
You said the conversation about trans athletes.
Yeah. How has it evolved in 25 years?
Well, for you. Like, how have your positions changed? Have they changed? How has it come to your attention?
Yeah, I think 25 years ago, I didn't understand a lot of some of the medicine and the science that goes into transitioning. And even over the last 10 to 12 years, as I've observed transgender athletes and talked with folks, my perspective has broadened. My perspective has become, I think, more inclusive of trans athletes, particularly in the women's category. But you know, I have very nuanced perspectives about it. I'm not all in, and I'm not all out. I think this is a conversation and information that's evolving, and I just appreciate people who are willing to have reasonable conversations about it and not yell at each other about it.
So likewise,
if you'd caught me 10 years ago and had said, hey, some of these regulatory groups are going to create rules that say, if you're post-op, post-surgery, if you're not producing testosterone anymore, that's basically what post-op means, right? You don't have testicles anymore. And if your testosterone levels are at a certain level and yada, 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 it's been so many number of years, then we'll allow athletes that have those sorts of qualifiers be allowed to participate in women's sports. And I would have been like, okay, that seems like there's some care being taken to try to ensure that there's a level playing field. And I think that there's still some sports bodies that set rules along those lines. Now, I feel a little differently now than I would have back then at that point. But having somebody who has at least gone through physical transition and whose testosterone levels are minimized, is that when you say that there's nuance in how you look at it yourself, is that the sort of thing that you're talking about?
You know, you asked me how it's changed. I'm sure you've talked about kind of the history of all of this stuff, but you know, back in the late 1970s, Renee Richards won in court the right to compete after having transitioned, and I think that was the first time that people really opened up and said, "Huh, maybe there is a path to inclusion." And I use that term all the time, a path to inclusion. And over the years, not just my perspective, but a lot of people's perspective has changed. In the early 2000s and then in the early 2010s, there have been different policies from IOC or the NCAA. Mm-hmm. Those policies to create a path to inclusion for trans women in the female category has at different times mandated surgery. There have been, you know, mandatory waiting periods of 2 years and 1 year. And now, of course, you know, some of the sports are going to 3 years and 4 years. And so it's not just my perspective that's changed. I think that people's perspective has changed. And all the way back to the 1970s, this is not a new conversation. There was Renee Richards played in the U.S. Open on the female side as a trans woman in the late 1970s. So people think, oh, this conversation just popped up out of nowhere. Well, it didn't really. I think for a lot of people, who've been paying attention to this stuff, this conversation has been going on for quite a long time. And I think that what's changed is all of a sudden people who weren't really paying attention to this, and a lot of whom don't even pay attention to women's sports, period, suddenly realized, wait, what happened? Wait, what did I miss? How did I miss this? My perspective hasn't changed in that I want to find a path to inclusion. I think what oscillates for me is what that path looks like.
How has it oscillated for you recently? Like, what's a recent, I don't know, what's something you've recently changed your mind on?
Sure. Yeah. So Nancy Hogshead Makar and I have had countless conversations about this. I mean, probably dozens of conversations about this. And Nancy, a couple of years ago, I'm sure you know who she is. Mm-hmm. Today, she is 100% trans women do not belong in the female category. But as she and I were talking a couple of years ago, what she wanted to do, what she was trying to do with, I think it was called the Women's Sports Policy Working Group, is find a blanket trans inclusion policy that could be applied to every sport. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I think over the last couple of years, I've come to realize that that's not a good idea, that every sport can and should be treated differently. For example, equestrian is a sport where men and women compete against one another. Other sports like curling that just take the strength and speed and sizes aren't as important as it is in powerlifting and boxing. So that's one of the ways that I've changed is that I think that different sports should have different policies and different levels of sport should have different policies.
Chess is classified as a sport. And I know recently there was a controversy about trans-identified chess player playing in the women's category. And that one made me pause.
Yeah.
That one was like, huh. The argument that I heard for that is if there are male and female categories in chess, we don't know why there are male and female categories, but if there are these categories, then female should be female and male should be male. But it really made me pause because it made me go like, well, why are there male and female categories in chess?
And the reason is to open up opportunities. The reason for chess in particular, and for most sports, the reason Title IX was created was so that for so long, these sports or games, whatever you want to call them, have been very male-dominated, very male-centric. And I think one of the ways to create opportunity and to build interest was Title IX. And it's interesting, people point to Title IX. Both sides point to Title IX as the reason that they're right. Pro-trans people say that, well, it means that you have to allow trans people because it protects gender, but Title IX actually doesn't mention gender. The word gender is not in Title IX. Title IX is sex-based. So that's why it was to create opportunities for female athletes and women. And at the time in 1972 or three, the definition of a woman was adult human female. And that definition has evolved for some people over time. So anyhow, that's the reason that it was that chess has two distinct categories. It's why there's women's football, but if a woman can play on a Division I men's team, they're welcome to.
Yeah, but there are other issues with safety in a lot of sports.
Oh yeah, chess especially, Nina. When you've got that timer clock that people are slapping, that requires reflexes, that requires 3D coordination, and we know men are better at that than women.
Yeah, but still, that's just opportunity. I'm talking about safety, right? So if you're doing tackle football or rugby, there is a safety issue beyond the dangers that women face in chess. There are additional physical dangers in contact sports that become.
Okay, let's talk about safety then. Let's talk about safety. So this past weekend, the South Carolina women's basketball team played against LSU women's basketball team. And there was a scuffle. And one of the South Carolina players shoved one of the LSU players to the ground. The LSU coach said that because the female player for South Carolina was 6'7", and the female player for LSU was only 5'10", that she shouldn't have done that. Hmm. Should we start regulating, just talking about just safety here, should basketball have rules about, you know, well, if you're over 6'5", you can't really push or shove anybody under 5'10", because that's an advantage. It's a safety issue.
Yeah, I think these category issues were addressed in a talk by Colin Wright at a GenSpec, at several conferences recently. So there are these questions of how we categorize things, and I don't have that handy. But that is a categorization.
But forget about how we categorize things. You're talking about just safety. In men's football, you have some men who are 350 pounds, and they're tackling somebody who's 170.
Yeah.
Is that safe?
No, sports aren't safe. Sports aren't safe, but they're people do things to make them as safe as possible. Like, there are guidelines for making them as safe as possible. And the question is, do you lift these guidelines? Do you throw away this category? Do you throw away the sex-based categories, given that it increases, it greatly increases risk to the female people, who as a class overall smaller and weaker. It doesn't mean every woman is smaller and weaker than every man. It doesn't mean every woman is the same size, but that's why we have men competing against men and women competing against women. It's not safe. People get hurt in sports, but it's like, do you want to increase that? Do you want to increase it for that reason? Like, I don't think it's realistic to say that it doesn't increase the risk of injury, particularly to one side of it, to the female side.
Well, I would say that it all depends. Size and weight are hugely important. I'm not sure that a 5'10" point guard poses a bigger threat to that 5'10" female point guard than a 6'7" woman. So if you're just, again, you wanted to focus just on safety. So if we're going to focus just on safety and we're going to build rules around safety, well, we need to rewrite the rules based on weight and height and other things.
Yeah, but I don't want to focus just on safety. I don't think I said that.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying, like, I'm a high school football referee. This past season, I saw the most horrific injury to a male player that, short of death, is not even possible. It was incredibly disturbing.
What happened?
In that same game, there were girls playing. Should they not be allowed to? Because it's just too unsafe. Are you saying that we should ban girls from high school football?
I just want to hear about I want to hear about the. Not. Can we hear about the injury? That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, what happened to that poor guy?
It was a broken leg. It was. Like, I mean, like the leg was like literally, literally was going the other way. Like it was, was brutal. It was brutal. But again, if you were talking about safety here, why would you not ban all girls from high school football? Because it's unsafe for them.
It's weird because I already said this. I'm not trying to make everything safe. I acknowledged flat out that sports are not safe. Especially not chess.
You're saying is that you're trying to limit the risk.
I am saying that is a consideration for making a decision that would greatly increase the risk and danger and vulnerability and injuries for one sex.
Yeah, especially in contact sports, right?
Yeah, so I'm not saying, like, we can't do this because everything has to be perfect and safe and no one can ever be injured. I'm not saying that. I'm saying a consequence of this is a vast, vast increase of risk for one sex. That's all.
Okay. I don't want to... What I don't have is all the data about how much of a risk that increases, but I'll accept on the face that there is... some kind of increase, given that males generally are stronger, generally are faster, and generally have higher bone density. So I'll just like accept that what you're saying is there is some increase. I'll accept that.
Well,
So
thank you.
I'm going to chip in really quick on just on that point, because I started estrogen when I was 18 years old, and that was you were five in 1999. I was four. I think we're a year apart, Sid. So I was precocious also, and I play tennis like Kim Jones does, not as well though. I play tennis, and I don't play competitive yet. I play in classes, but the men are so strong. It is like it is shocking how strong the men are, and even though of all the males who are in that class, I am definitely the runt when it comes to body strength. The other two factors that you just talked about, size and bone density, are things that I still retain. So if you were to look at all of the athletes that I play with in classes, you would have all the men grouped up at the top, then I would be sort of at the very bottom of the men. And for doing nothing on my part except for having been born male, I have a lot of advantages over the women in the program. So it's sort of weird for me being in that space, because the men would kick my ass just top to bottom when you only factor in like talent, but then add in the other like natural proficiencies. The fact that I'm 5'10", it gives me a huge advantage.
Well, not over
If
taller
Novak
women.
Djokovic played the top woman in the world in tennis, she wouldn't win a game.
Oh yeah.
I mean, anybody who thinks otherwise, I mean, maybe she could eke out a game, maybe.
Yeah.
But the power of their serve is just, she certainly won't break him. And so I, of course, totally accept that. I think that the question, and you asked me how I've evolved, and I think it's how people have evolved. And it's why I think the work that Joanna Harper is trying to do
Yeah.
in really researching how are athletes affected by transition, I think that's incredibly powerful. And I 10, 20 years from now will have a much better idea on that. I think right now the struggle is we're trying to figure something out, and we don't have the answers.
Yeah,
We're
we're
all
going
trying
to.
to weigh inclusion and fairness and equality and safety, all these things, without knowing the stuff that Joanne is going to hopefully teach
Yeah.
us in the next decade.
Well, it's an absolute fact. I've said this to other people, is that if we assemble enough data about trans athletes competing in college and professional sports, we are going to have a body of data that's going to answer a very specific question, is if males have an advantage in competing in a female sports category, what percentage? It's going to vary by sport, but what percentage is that advantage? And some sports, it might be 0%. And when we have that data, maybe we go backwards and we say there's like a equestrian sports or riflery or long distance running where women tend to catch up with men, ultra marathons, not regular marathons. Maybe in those cases that we say, look, there's no practical reason that we would have even segregation by sex in these sports if there's no real comparative difference in the outcomes.
Well, but then we're back to chess, right? Because
Well,
chess
I mean, we were
is
talking
this issue
about
of.
the speed of hitting the clock.
But then there's also this issue of these opportunities, right? Which is there. I mean, so it's like, yeah, men have a number of physical advantages, but not in chess.
The question about opportunity is really important because, again, women just do not have equal access to resources in sports, finances of sports. And I think that continuing to build opportunities is important. And it's why one of the ways, the other ways that I've evolved is, so people talk about creating a transgender category in sports. The reason that pretty much one of the only reasons I don't like it is that I just don't think that there are enough, there's enough interest to even have races. But if there was, and if it was able to open more opportunities and more interest and draw transgender people into sports where they may have otherwise felt excluded, I think then there's a real conversation to be had. I think most of the time that people talk about a trans category, they're using it to exclude trans people. But I think that there, years from now, there could be an opportunity. Like, there are some transgender teams out there, local teams, you know, Weekend Warriors. And I think that's great because it's opening opportunities for a whole group of people who feel so excluded. And I think that's, again, going back to the women's category in a lot of these things years ago, that was one of the most, the best parts of it is that it opened up these opportunities and built interest around an excluded group.
I thought that there was a push for open categories, not for trans categories.
Well, whatever you call it, I'm open to anything that builds interest in sports. Sports brings so much to people's lives who are able to compete in it. And so whatever you call it, again, I think generally people point to it in a way to try to exclude them. But I do see intellectually, again, the way that women's category was used to build interest amongst women. If there's a way to use these things to build interest among trans people, get them out there swimming and running and hitting a softball, I am for that if it's used in the right way.
Yeah, I'm for that too. I mean, I love the idea of trans leagues, and also I love the idea of open categories. I think everyone
The
wants
problem with the
that.
open category, of course, is I trans women can't compete with cisgender men at an elite level in
That's
sports. They just
true.
can't. They can't.
I got to tell you a secret, Sin. And this might be a little contentious, so I apologize. I shouldn't even preface it by saying that. But there are some people who transition, and they're, do you know what a, have you heard the term external locus of control before?
No.
Okay. So there, just to preface this very shortly, there's this idea of, it's called a internal versus external locus of control. And all it means is, do you feel good about yourself because you can generate those feelings internally? Or do you only ever feel good about yourself and other people tell you that they like you? Okay. So there's other implications about an internal versus external locus of control. But there are some people who can't develop an internal locus of control, who only feel validated when people keep telling them over and over, it's okay that you are who you are. It's okay that you do what you do. Now, this isn't by any means at all all trans people, but I think when we look at some of the most divisive and most public figures of trans athletes that are in women's sports, that my impression of a number of them, there's a UK cyclist who fits this example. I won't pick on names, but there's a few UK cyclists, so there's one in particular whose attitude reflects, I am in this sport so that the world will see that I'm a woman. And that if I'm not allowed to compete in this category as a woman, then that's proof that people don't see me as a woman. And I think that that's something that people who transition, they have to manage that type of emotional and personal development internally and not have to rely on other people to give them that affirmation for them to feel like they're being genuine or true to themselves.
I appreciate that. I hear what you're saying, and I accept what you're saying. The way I take it is not necessarily that that again, I don't know exactly who you're talking about. I might, but the way I take it isn't that they need validation. It's that they experience outright rejection. It's that
Yes.
you, is that it's not that I need you to tell me I'm a woman. It's you are flat out telling me I'm not. And so I think there is an important difference there.
So, but if, you know, when the fundamentalist said, tell you, you're not really a gay man, you're a man who's either your father was absent, or you haven't found the right woman, or God has a plan for you, and it involves, I don't know what they say. Actually, I can imagine based on what they say to me. That doesn't make you feel less gay, though, right?
Well, I will say this. I think there was certainly a time when it made me pissed off.
Yeah.
Today, I just laugh at them because I'm so widely accepted as a gay man. I'm legally married. Like, I don't. There's nothing you can do to me.
Yes.
But I think that there's a difference, because I think trans women and trans men have this overwhelming feeling. I think they're widely rejected as women and men. And I think that is the difference, is that I can imagine being a gay man in the 1980s and really feeling horrible about the attacks through AIDS and the church. I just think I'm so much more widely accepted today that it doesn't matter to me what you think. Does that make sense?
Oh, no, it does. I think you might recognize, thinking about that a lot of that had to do with your own emotional maturation from the time that you're a young adult, probably up until the time that you're in your 20s and 30s. And even if society were as regressive as it was back I graduated high school in 93. I'm guessing you probably did in 92, thereabouts. You don't have to answer, but no, yeah,
I don't care. I joke. I'm 50. So yes, 91 is when I graduated from high school.
91. Okay. So, you graduated young.
Well, I was 18.
Yeah. I was a June baby. So I graduated the week that I turned 18. Anyway. Oh, where was I going with that? Why did I say that, Nina?
Maturation. You're maturation. Talking about individual
right.
maturation.
So yes. even if things were as regressive today as they were back in the early and mid 90s, I think you still would have gone through that same sort of process of becoming more confident with who you are, having more direction and that internal sense of knowing that you're making the right choices for yourself.
Sure. And I would also be marching on Washington. I would be throwing a fit today at 50 if our rights as gay people were where they were in 1991. I would absolutely, I mean, listen, I write about LGBTQ athletes. So I'm engaged in this fight to an extent. But if it was where we were 35 years ago, I would absolutely have a different approach to the work.
Yeah, that's sensible. I'm going to use that to go into a follow-up question with that. So things have changed so much in 25 years. When it comes to, let's set trans aside for just a second. When it comes to gays and lesbians in sports, what type of barriers are there still for athletes at the college and professional, and we could even say high school levels, for participation in sports, equal treatment in sports?
So the acceptance level at all levels of sports is very high. Generally, of course, you could find a locker room that's problematic, or, you know, maybe in the South, it's a little bit harder than it is in Massachusetts. We did a study a couple of years ago, the Out in Sports study, where we surveyed 1,000 coming out experiences, the actual people who actually came out in high school and college sports. And the vast majority over the last 20 years have experienced widespread acceptance from their teammates. The two problems that I see are, number one, locker room language. Locker room language, particularly in men's sports, is extremely heterocentric. So much conversation about sex with women, hot women, and women's body parts. And in lower levels, like high school, there is the issue of homophobic language and slurs, even from coaches. By the time we get to the pros, it's almost non-existent, but in high school it is. So that language it betrays the actual acceptance that is there waiting for athletes to come out in the locker room. Because when you hear this constant heterosexist language, heteronormative language, you just think, I don't belong here. I and many other people, Brock McGillis is a great guy in hockey who speaks all over North America to hockey locker rooms about this. And his approach and my approach is, I assume that you would accept a gay teammate. And that is a huge change from 20 years ago. Huge. I think that almost everyone in this room would accept a gay teammate. But the problem is you're using language that betrays how you actually feel about them. And these are just some ways to change your language. So, and interestingly, there are 1,000 coming out experiences in this study. I think like 28 were trans athletes, and the trans athletes' acceptance from teammates was lower than lesbians and gay men. But it was still the majority felt that their teammates, maybe not their opponents, but their teammates supported them. So I think that is the biggest thing. That is the number one hurdle is people in sports just realizing everything that I'm told from the locker room language and the media is wrong.
There was you mentioned hockey. There was something, I think two years ago, the NHL had a program where they had pride, like the pride flag type of stuff on their uniforms. And then I think last year they dropped that program. And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it was last September, October, and somebody told me that the NHL was going to had sent a memo to its team banning pride tape on rainbow colored tape on hockey sticks to ban the players from supporting the LGBT community on ice. And I flipped out because that just seemed to me not just backward in hockey's ability to express support, but also infringed on players' ability to say what they want, speak their mind. So, yeah, I wrote a story, and yeah, the media and players flipped out, and there was a revolt. I mean, one of the players said, "F you, I'm doing it anyway." And the league very quickly realized that they had a mutiny on their hands, and so they rescinded it, thankfully.
Yeah, I guess people don't like being pushed around like that.
The players didn't like the league, after all these years of allowing it, the league telling the players, you don't get to choose this yourself. And that's what I think players revolting over it. That's what really got them to change their mind.
Are religious symbols permitted?
Well, I think religion. Hockey has. So, you know, every sport has rules about equipment and what you can wear. There's tape that they put at the end of their hockey sticks, and is generally white and black. And a few years ago, a couple players used pride tape, and there was this whole conversation, was that even allowed? And they decided that it was. I don't know if you start putting like logos on the tape, or like if you put a cross on the tape, I just don't know. It's kind of like in football, you can wear eye black, but it has to be a solid color because people started putting words and all kinds of stuff on it. So I don't know. I can't imagine that there's anything against wearing, you know, a cross under your jersey. I don't know.
Where it's not visible, but I mean visible.
I just don't know. I'm not familiar with all of the rules. I know that when players started doing this pride tape, they allowed it. Doubt you can start putting your phone number and like symbols. I doubt it, but I don't know.
You could start hawking websites like GoDaddy on your hockey stick.
Yeah, corporate logos they would never allow. I just don't know, like Stars of David, and can you allow BLM? And there is a point at which it becomes a slippery slope. But the problem with the league was, they allowed the pride tape, and after 5 or 6 or 7 years, they suddenly decided no more. And that was the problem. The players were given the right to do it, and after all these years, it was taken away from them, and that's why they fought back.
One of the non-traversies over the last couple of years that I really don't buy into at all is the outrage over players kneeling during the national anthem. Like, who cares if a player kneels or not? And the fact that those players got so much media attention from the people who didn't like it, like, you're feeding the very thing that you think that you're opposed to. You're causing it to gain that attention. So it's so silly. And some of the critics of players doing this said, well, you're being paid to be there. You're supposed to do what the team tells you to do. But these little types of personal expressions that don't have any material impact on the gameplay, that show a little bit of the personality or viewpoints of the players, I don't see what the harm of it actually is.
Well, the kneeling actually came because Colin Kaepernick sat for the national anthem, and he had a conversation with a veteran, a private conversation, and he and the veteran, military veteran, came out of the meeting and said, we've kind of come to a compromise where he's not going to sit anymore, he's going to kneel. And kneeling, there is a reverence to kneeling. And so it was, the kneeling came from this conversation that he had with a military veteran. And this is what they both said: we like where this is. And of course, that wasn't enough for a lot of people. I'm not a big fan of the kneeling. Like, I don't really care what you do. I'm going to stand every time. But yeah, like, it just, the whole kerfuffle about it, I was, for me, I just didn't care that much. The one time I would say, maybe if you're literally playing for Team USA, maybe don't do it then. But what people didn't talk about, the NBA banned kneeling. The NBA had a like, you had to stand. You had to be there and you had to stand. And nobody talked about that for whatever reason.
When did they ban that?
In the 1990s, there was a player who, I think he sat and he did this, or it was some kind of demonstration, and they said, no more demonstrations. You're standing and you're going to put your hands behind your back, and that's the way it is. So that was way before Colin Kaepernick.
You know, thinking about even Team USA, I guess one thing that you could demonstrate by encouraging the players to kneel if they felt their consciousness required them to do that is that I bet there are more totalitarian countries that wouldn't let their players do that. So at least maybe what you could demonstrate is the United States has more freedom of expression.
And that's why ultimately, like, again, I'm not a huge fan of it. I just didn't get bent out of shape because at the end of the day, it is a demonstration of what I think America does represent to the vast majority of the world, is that you can pretty much do what you want and say what you want. And I, you know, even with Megan Rapinoe now representing Team USA, I was like, well, I don't love that, but still a positive demonstration to the rest of the world. Most places would not let you do that.
Wait, what did Megan Rapinoe do?
She knelt during the national anthem, representing Team USA. And, you know, some of the national team, more and more of them did that. Some of the players said, I don't like this at all. But I think it's interesting, the kneeling, you don't hear much about the kneeling anymore. The kneeling is kind of out of fashion.
That's such an unfortunate way of putting it, though. Because it makes it sound like when they were kneeling that was just a fashion.
No, that's not what I meant. I think that
a lot of
players really, really, they meant what they did. It's just, yeah, it's not getting headlines anymore. The message is kind of lost a little, you know. And I think Brittany Griner's detention in Russia, I think that changed how a lot of people looked at it and how the United States went and got her out. I mean, she said it. I mean, she's standing for the national anthem. And she was either, like, she would stay in the locker room. I can't remember what it was. But I think that really opened a lot of people's eyes. Like, okay, there's stuff can be bad in the U.S. Thank God we're not Russian.
Hmm. I've dated a Russian, so I can tell you that's absolutely correct. You're not Russian, are you?
I'm not. I'm
okay, thank God. I just realized.
North European.
I don't care about you.
Nina, you're Russian?
Well, Belarusian.
Belarus.
Oh,
Belarusian, yeah. That's where Paleys come from.
I guess I am too, Nina.
Yeah, we're from the Pale, you and I.
We are.
Galicia.
That's true.
Nina, are you a sports fan? Are you an athlete?
I am not a spectator sports fan, but Corinna thinks that I'm an athlete because I do a lot of bicycling. I bike long distances.
How many 100-mile bicycle trips did you do last year? How many centuries?
I don't know. Between 10 and 20. The year before, I did 24, I think.
I think that counts as being an athlete.
It's, you know, it's more athletic than I ever thought I would be. I don't identify as an athlete, okay? But I do these long rides.
What you said is interesting. Like, it's athletic, but I'm not necessarily an athlete. I think the word athlete, we connect to competition.
Yeah.
Going back to how we started talking about transgender athletes, nobody's stopping anybody from going out and playing pickup basketball or riding your bike for 100 miles or running a marathon. It is that competition part of that word that I think it's so part of the crux of this conversation. Nobody is stopping anybody from getting on their bike and riding as far as you want. Nobody.
Yeah.
It's that competition part.
I attended the Icons conference in Denver last summer, and I was surprised by how moving I found it because I'm just not into sports. But these women were unabashed about being competitive and competing to win. Like, I had thought of, like, women's sports, women are supposed to be nice, it's about teamwork and blah, blah, blah. And these women were just flat out, we are excellent and we want to win. And like, that changed me, because as a woman, I have been raised to think that that's bad. There's something wrong with that. That it's not nice. You know, I was amazed by them. I really was.
Yeah. I've never thought that. My sister was a competitive athlete when I was younger. And so being a female athlete, is that competition part has always been striving to be better and striving to be the other person and striving to set a record. And certainly when you talk to Nancy Hogs,
what she went through being raped at Duke.
Hey, I'm going to
hang on a second.
I'm going to interrupt you. Something went with your audio.
I think did your mic fall off?
We've had bears interrupt recording our podcast before, but I don't think that's necessarily what's going on this time.
I don't know. Is your husband a bear?
He's not. He's a wolf.
Oh.
He's kind of like a fit bear. I'm not a bear. Like, I'm sorry. I don't know what to do. I mean, my phone is plugged in. I'm connected to the internet. He's stuck.
It's fine. So it sounds like we're having a technical issue, and that Corinna, the tech support llama, is not going to be able to fix it this time. Sid, I know you have out sports, and there's probably some other things that you're working on. Could you briefly just tell us a little bit about that? And then please, if you can't hear Sid clearly, go check out our show notes and you can learn more about Sid.
Yeah, OutSports at OutSports.com. We write about LGBT athletes and everything involved. Our Out Athlete Fund, which is raising money to support the training of out LGBT athletes ahead of the Olympic Games. So go to outathletefund.org. And I appreciate the conversation. You know, people who don't necessarily agree being able to have conversations about this and laugh and still disagree, I appreciate it.
We do too. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, TERFs and trannies, this game ended before overtime. In undertime, it was canceled. It was called on rain. It was called on. I don't know how you. What are some good analogies?
You're the tennis player. I just ride bikes.
The balls froze. That doesn't happen in tennis. Sid. Thank you for joining us, and so long, TERFs and Trannies.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.